Before I start speaking, there's some regulatory housekeeping. As a member in good standing of the Conference Speakers Guild of England, Scotland, Wales, I am required to insert a joke here about being the last speaker of the day and being between you and the bar. I've made that joke now, and I will go on. So people who come to events like this are pretty likely to be in the business of earning their livings online. And even if you're not earning your living online today, you probably will be tomorrow, because everything we do today involves the internet, and everything we do tomorrow will require it. The wonderful thing about earning a living from creative labor is that there are so many ways to do it. Virtually every commercially successful artist is a one-off, earning her living in a way that is distinct from what everyone else is doing. Practically everyone who's ever set out to earn a living from the creative arts has failed. In fact, most people who set out to earn a living in creative labor will lose money on the deal. And that's true not just now, but always, independent of your medium, your era, or the technology around you. No one's ever really come up with a policy that would make everybody who wants to be an artist a middle-class member of society, apart from if you call yourself an artist, we'll give you £40,000 a year until you stop. Indeed, making a living in a creative field is so rare that it's possible that it's just a statistical anomaly, a kind of Six Sigma event. Like, imagine that we had a competition for flipping coins, right? And everybody stood in a line and flipped coins as quickly as they could. A certain number of them would land on edge, one or two out of millions and millions. And maybe the people who threw those were very good at coin flipping, and maybe they've devoted many hours to flipping coins and practicing it. But it's obvious that the thing that unites people who manage to get their coins to land edge on is that is not skill. It's their luck. It's that perfect storm of the lucky wind, the lucky toss, the lucky landing. If winners of the edge on coin toss were feted and handsomely paid and featured on the covers of magazines, it's likely that a lot of people would try to pursue a living as coin tossers. And again, I'm contractually obliged to note that a person with a Canadian accent said tosser. After all, people buy lottery tickets. And what's more, if flipping coins was a deeply, profoundly satisfying human experience that made a heartfelt connection between the coin tosser and her audience, living in a coin toss world would be downright noble. And this is effectively the arts, because making art is innate to our condition. Babies make art. We treat PTSD with art therapy. Singing and telling stories and making pictures, these things seem to be built into the human condition. And we treat successful artists with a reverence bordering on worship, which certainly makes for an attractive proposition, at least from the outside looking in. But the arts are foundationally a non-market activity. People who set out to make a living from the arts are not engaged in rational economic calculus. They're setting out to win the edge on coin contest, where beyond trying and practicing a lot, there's no way to win without getting very, very lucky. Which, when we talk about the internet and the arts, we tend to focus on which business models serve artists best. But that's just backwards. There are so many people pursuing the arts at any given moment that whatever business model works at that particular moment will have no shortage of matching artists waiting to take advantage to it. And when we try to preserve the business models that worked last year, what we're really saying is that last year's lottery winners should be guaranteed to win this one, which is a nice deal for the lottery winners, and I'm one of those lottery winners, so I'm not entirely opposed to that proposition, but it's the kind of cure that's likely to be worse than the disease, because business models aren't there in a vacuum. They reflect wider social realities, technology, economics, politics, and tastes. And when you freeze the old business models, you do so at the expense of everyone who would succeed in the new ones. And you end up going to war against the technological, economic, political, and social factors that are selecting for those new business models. Now, speaking as an artist who found a niche in the business models of the past two decades and is hoping to find a niche in the following couple of decades, I'm here to suggest that our priority shouldn't be to defend business models. It should be to ensure that whichever business model works right now, that it keeps as much control as is practical in the hands of the creators first, their investors second, and last and least, the retailers and platforms through which they reach their audiences. And to that end, I'm going to propose three ironclad laws for keeping the money flowing the right way. Things that we can choose as creators, that politicians and regulators can enact, that audiences and businesses can act upon, to put money in the pockets of the people most directly involved with making the art that we love. And as an aside, I started with one law, and I mentioned it to my agent, who's also the Arthur C. Clarke estate agent and was Clarke's agent, and he said, "You're not allowed to have one law. You need to have three."
So the first law is this, Dr. O's first law. Anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you, but they won't give you the key, they didn't put that lock there for your benefit. So if you've ever uploaded a digital product of your imagination to Steam or Amazon or Apple, you've been given a little tick box that says protect this file or maybe turn piracy protection on. And if you're with a major publisher or label or studio, I'll just call all of those publishers for ease here, chances are that they've already made that choice for you and ticked that box. And what the tick box does is add this layer of what's called digital rights management, or DRM, to your work, which is supposed to stop people from making copies of your work without your permission. Though in practice, it's just not very good at this. For it to work, digital rights management has to somehow provide the audience with the key that they need to descramble your work, but somehow prescribe what they do with that key, so that they only descramble the work in order to watch it or hear it or play it once, and then they throw away the unscrambled version rather than sharing that with their friends or watching it later without having to rely on your key. Now, hiding a key in something that your adversary owns and can inspect and manipulate at will is just a pretty dumb idea, especially when your adversary is everybody in the world who not only wants to get access to your work, but wants to get access to any other work protected with the same DRM scheme. And when that everybody in the world includes bored grad students with electron tunneling microscopes, that stuff just doesn't last. I mean, in security, we call that crypto model wishful thinking. But of course, it's illegal to break the locks, thanks to laws like the EUCD of 2001, which became law here in the UK in 2003 through the Copyright and Related Rights Regulations Act. And there are other versions of this law in pretty much every industrialized country in the world, and a lot of developing nations. Now, it also doesn't stop people from breaking locks. In fact, the easiest way to break the lock off of any work that you want to get access to is to just go to the Pirate Bay and download a copy that somebody else broke the lock off of, because why should two people have to do the same thing twice? But does it mean that once Apple or Amazon or Adobe, and that's just the A's, put its lock on your copyrighted works, that it does mean, rather, that when they put their locks on one of your copyrighted works, you lose control over it and over the customer who owns that work, who bought that work. The customer is now permanently bonded to the company that installed the lock. Because the only way to convert a book from Apple's iBook store to run on Google Play, the only way to convert it to run on Amazon Kindle, is to unlock that book first before you can convert it. And there's the only company that's allowed in law to authorize a conversion from iBooks is Apple. Just as only Google can authorize a conversion from Google Play to Amazon Video, and so on and so on. Which means that inevitably, when your digital distributor, when the platform company whose sole creative contribution to the work is running it through a script, wants to negotiate a bigger scale of the purchase price, a bigger share of the purchase price, you can't afford to turn their distributor down. Because if you stop selling through Amazon and give discounts at Google to tempt your customers to convert their libraries and follow along with you, none of your best customers will be able to afford to take you up on the offer. Because the only way to go from Amazon to Google or Apple to Adobe is to dump all your purchased media and buy it again in the new format, or maintain two separate ecosystems that you flip between depending on which retailer you bought the media from. And this is not a hypothetical example. Right now, you may have heard that one of the five largest publishers in the world, Hachette, a company that is no stranger to strategic relations, they make their parent company makes cluster bombs for use in the developing world. They're pretty good at military thinking. One of the five largest publishers in the world is terribly losing a fight with Amazon over how much money from their books Amazon gets to keep. And Amazon will absolutely win that fight, because Hachette has insisted since day one that all of its books have to be sold with Amazon's DRM. So Hachette's customers, more than any other publishers, are locked into Amazon's ecosystem. And if Hachette takes its business elsewhere, the customers will remain in Amazon's walled garden. And it's just going to get worse. There's another Amazon division, Audible, that controls 90% of the audiobooks sold in the world. They're the only audiobook supplier for iTunes, and they don't even give you the option of selling without DRM. And they've already started to put the screws to the audiobook publishers and studios. And this isn't going to let up. Now, I'll bet you a testicle, not one of my testicles, that they're going to start locking their suppliers out of their store unless they agree to enormous concessions in the revenue split and marketing of their books. Just like Apple did with apps, also sold with mandatory DRM, as soon as they gained mandatory platform dominance. Do you remember when Apple would sell your app for 30% and let you keep 100% of the money that your app earned? Now they sell your app for 30% and they keep 30% of the money your app earned. Not until a lot of people had sunk their fortunes into making apps for Apple. and all of those suppliers are going to cave. Because every serious audiobook customer, the 20% who represent 80% of the sales, have sunk thousands of pounds into an investment that's locked it to Amazon until Amazon decides to unlock it, and that is to say, forever. Anytime someone promises to protect you by locking up your stuff and won't give you a key to unlock it, they're not protecting you. Which brings me to law number two. Fame won't make you rich, but you can't sell your art without it. You'll have heard Tim O'Reilly say, for most artists, the problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. And he didn't mean that once you're famous, you automatically become rich, but rather, if no one's heard of your stuff, they're not going to buy it. Of course, many people who have heard of your stuff are also not going to buy it, but none of the people who are ignorant of your very existence are ever going to give you anything. In the 21st century, the way that people discover you is on the internet, through search engines and social media, through online hosting providers like YouTube, and the way you get paid for stuff is also through the internet. Payment processors like PayPal, ad brokers like Google, crowdfunders like Kickstarter. The internet has spawned many independent successes who piece together all the functions of a publisher from these bits and pieces lying around on the internet. Some were artists who started off in the traditional world and made the jump to indie, like Trent Reznor or Amanda Palmer, and some were artists who started as indies and made the jump into the mainstream, like XKCD's Randall Monroe or Hugh Howey, the author of Wool. And some artists just stayed indie, like Jonathan Colton. The world of big content has been seized by the same industrial concentration as has impacted every other sector. There are 5 publishers, 4 labels, 4 studios left in the world. And when there's less competition among buyers, the publishers, then the sellers, the creators, get a worse deal. And the big boys' contracts, they reflect this deal. You know, if you sign a record label, chances are you have to sign away the right for them to deduct from your royalties, every royalty statement, a fixed percentage for breakage. Now, what's breakage? Breakage dates back to the era of vinyl record albums and shellac albums. It represents the fraction of physical product that is shattered by being dropped on the way from the factory to the retailer. They deduct that from your MP3 royalties. If you're a novelist signing with one of the big 5, chances are you're going to be asked to sign away your graphic novel rights, possibly your film rights, your international rights, and almost always your audiobook rights, and so on. Now, the existence of the indie channel presents a kind of competitor of last resort to the big guys. The worst deal the big guys can offer you, economically speaking, has to be better than the best deal you think that you can get if you go it on your own. The existence of the indie channel, even for artists who don't go indie, sets the floor on the terms that the publishers can offer. So it follows that the more competitive that indie channel is, the more companies there are providing more services, the better the deal will be for artists, whether they go indie or sign to one of the bigs. But the indie sector is being clobbered by the big entertainment companies. For example, Viacom asked the US Supreme Court to rule that YouTube should be liable for any copyright infringement in videos that they hosted unless they somehow determined perfectly and a priori whether those videos infringed copyright. That is, unless each and every one of the 96 hours of videos uploaded to YouTube every minute was reviewed by a copyright lawyer to evaluate whether or not it was legal. Now, even if there was the money to pay the lawyers to do this, and it would be full employment for anyone with a legal background from now until forever, there just aren't enough solicitors, not only now, but in the entire history of the world, to make a dent in this. You know, you would run out of lawyer hours before you reach the heat-death of the universe here. Now, there's nothing particular in the position that Viacom took that makes YouTube liable for infringement that wouldn't have made Google or every other online service like Twitter and Blogger and Facebook also liable for this. Now, how would a company in Viacom's theory resolve this? It's simple. They just do it the way cable does. Right? If you want to put something on cable, you have to indemnify the cable company that to make sure that it doesn't infringe copyright. And the way the cable company makes sure that you can offer them indemnity is making sure you're insured. And when you go to the insurer, they make you hire a lawyer to evaluate your work and make sure it doesn't infringe. In other words, anyone will be able to speak on the internet so long as they've got as much money as a big label or studio. And if they don't, they can't. Which is to say, we will replicate in miniature the outside world and the inside world of the internet. And it gets worse because efforts like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and the ad hoc efforts by and the legal enforcement of the City of London Police with their intellectual property unit have all sought to extend similar kinds of liability, not just to people who host content, but to payment brokers, ad brokers, domain registrars, social media platforms, and so on. And just as digital rights management doesn't stop people from making copies, this stuff doesn't stop people from finding illegal copies. The darknet, for one thing, is immune to this kind of enforcement, and there are innumerable other channels for finding this stuff. After all, the way the net works is to make copies. The way that you know the internet is working is if the copies are being made cheaply, quickly, and faithfully. Making the internet worse at copying is like making water less wet. So all this does is reduce the diversity and competitiveness in the services to indie creators sector, and it makes it harder for you to get a better deal out of your publisher to make your work known so that you can earn something from it. Because although fame won't make you rich, no one will give you money unless they've heard of you. And now we come to the third, final, and most important law, which is that information does not want to be free. You may have heard that this discussion of copyright and the internet hinges on whether information wants to be free, but I had a revelation last spring. I invited information away for a kind of drumming retreat in the Cotswolds, and we hired a cabin, we built a fire, we painted ourselves, we danced, we chanted, we sang, we drank oaky Chardonnay and cried about our parents, and when it was over, a fragrant, stubbly internet information gave me a long, soulful hug and whispered its confession in my ear that it does not want to be free. All it wants from us, all information wants from any of us, is to stop anthropomorphizing information. Because information's just an abstraction, and it doesn't want a damn thing. I haven't devoted my life to this stuff because I want to help information achieve its goals. This is a fight about people, and people want to be free. In the information age, you can only be free if you have free and fair information systems. When we frame the question of regulating the internet as a way of improving the lot of the decimal 0.00001% of the world who earn their living in the arts, we treat the net as though it were a glorified video-on-demand service. But it's not. And despite what the Home Office thinks, it's not a system for perfecting jihad, and it's not a better pornography distribution system. What the internet is the nervous system of the 21st century through which every one of our activities are mediated. Everything we do today involves the net, and everything we do tomorrow will require it. So while it's true that DRM gets a bad deal for creators and publishers and audiences, that's just a sideshow. The real cost of DRM is that in order to make it work, virtually every country in the world has made it illegal to tell people information that would help them remove DRM. And that means that it's illegal to report vulnerabilities, flaws in the code of DRM, which means that anyone who tells you about vulnerabilities in your phone or your computer or your thermostat or your automobile firmware or the apps that control your hearing aid or pacemaker can go to jail for doing so, which means that the devices that we rely on as a matter of life and limb are being turned into long-lived reservoirs of vulnerabilities ripe for exploitation by creeps and voyeurs, identity thieves, spies, cops, and governments. Our world is made of computers. Your car is a computer that hurtles down the motorway at 60 miles per hour with you trapped inside of it. Your modern building, a new build house or a public institution, is a computer that you happen to reside in. When you remove the computers from most of those buildings, they cease to be inhabitable immediately. If you don't turn them back on again pretty quick, most of those buildings turn into teardowns because without the ability to regulate their respiration, they start to rot almost immediately. You and me and everyone else who's grown up with Walkman headphones or earbuds, we have logged enough punishing headphone hours that there will come a day when we will all need hearing aids. And that hearing aid is not going to be a beige retro hipster analog transistorized device. It's going to be a computer that you put in your head. And depending on how that computer is designed and regulated, it will be able to stop you from hearing things that are there. It will be able to make you hear things that aren't there. It'll be able to tell other people what you've heard. I was in an airport lounge a couple of months ago. I spent a lot of time in airport lounges. And of course, the first rule of airport lounges is ABC, always be charging. And I got to the airport lounge first. I seized the high ground, the sole mains outlet in the airport lounge, plugged my lappy in, was sitting there working when a man came up and very cheekily said, "Can I use that electrical outlet?" And I said, "I'm charging my laptop." And he rolled up his trouser leg and showed me the prosthetic he was wearing from the knee down and said, "I need to charge my leg." And I unplugged my laptop and said, "It's all yours." Stacking the deck against disclosure of flaws in the devices we rely on for everything is an insane idea. You should be allowed to know about the flaws in your iPhone, a device that has a camera, a mic, a location sensor, and who knows who all your friends are and what you talk to about them. You should be allowed to know about the flaws in your iPhone, even if your knowing about those flaws makes it harder for Apple to maintain a monopoly over where you buy your apps. And when it comes to increasing liability for service providers, the major effect has nothing to do with the arts. Because the 96 hours of video landing in YouTube's inbox every minute are not amateur movies or pirate TV, they're personal communications, they're dialogue, they're dissent footage from war zones, they're the raw stuff of communication. Same for tweets and Facebook posts and the whole bit. And this is where some cynic usually says, this is about preserving all that rubbish on Facebook, all that garbage on Twitter, all those pictures of cats. This is the emblem of people who want to dismiss all the stuff that happens on the internet. And I'm supposed to say, no, there's noble things on the internet too. There's people talking about surviving abuse and people reporting police violence and so on. And all that stuff is important, but I'm going to speak for the banal and trivial here for a minute. Because when my wife comes down in the morning, and I get up first, I get up at 5 a.m., I'm an early riser. When my wife comes down in the morning and I ask her how she slept, it's not because I want to know how she slept. I sleep next to my wife. I know how my wife slept. The reason I ask how my wife slept is because it is a social signal that says, I see you, I care about you, I love you, I'm here. And when someone says something big and meaningful, like, I've got cancer, or I won, or I lost my job, the reason those momentous moments have meaning is because they've been built up out of this hummus of a million seemingly insignificant transactions. And if someone else's insignificant transactions seem banal to you, it's because you're not the audience for that transaction. They are. They and their social milieu are. And it is the height of arrogance to say that in order to make sure that people watch telly the right way, we are willing to surveil, censor, or abandon altogether the channels through which people do that. We have set up systems by which any file can be removed from the internet merely by pointing at it and saying, I aver that that file infringes my copyright without presenting a shred of evidence, and there's no penalty for abusing it. This notice and takedown regime is routinely abused by all kinds of scumbags, from the King of Thailand to homegrown UK neo-Nazis. Because if you set up a system of censorship without due process and no penalty for abuse, it would be criminally naive to not expect it to be abused. And here in the UK, we have the Digital Economy Act of 2010, the last act of the last parliament passed in the last hours before they prorogued for the election on a three-line whip during the wash-up. Any Labour MP who didn't vote for it would have lost her job and the party backing on the eve of the election campaign. And that was passed without any parliamentary debate, and it allows the business secretary, which was then Peter Mandelson and now Vince Cable, to make a rule at his or her discretion that says that anyone with an internet connection who's implicated in three unfounded and evidence-free accusations of internet infringement can be connected from the internet for a year. Which means that if you are merely accused of living in the vicinity of a piece of network equipment that some unknown party may or may not have used to listen to music inappropriately, you and everyone who lives in your house gets the internet death penalty for a year. So Martha Lane Fox, who's now Baroness Soho, which, like, all this royalty stuff always makes me feel a bit Dungeons and Dragons-y, but Baroness Soho is cool. Martha Lane Fox, before she was Baroness Soho, she had an equally improbably cool-sounding job. She was the champion for digital inclusion, and one of her first acts was to commission PricewaterhouseCooper to find out what happens when people get the internet. So they went off and studied a council estate in the north where people had internet access for a couple of years for free. They just happened to be the council estate that was closest to where the nearest DSL drop was. They got wired up. It wasn't like they signed up for it or anything. And they compared it to the people in the nearby estates who just didn't have this bit of geographic luck. And what they found was that the families whose estate had been chosen, when compared to the families in the neighboring estate, had better educational outcomes, better nutrition, better jobs, more disposable income, less debt, more social mobility, were more likely to participate in civil society, were better informed about politics, and were more likely to vote. When we as a society are prepared to collectively punish whole families who are accused without evidence of being entertained without permission, by severing them from the single wire that delivers free speech, a free press, free assembly, access to education, to health, nutrition, wealth, civic and political engagement, then it is clear as day that this is not a fight about information, but about people. Now, I happen to believe that I can earn my living without it being necessary to spy on everyone, without being granted censorship authority over the internet, without a system as manifestly unfair and grotesque as Peter Mandelson's Digital Economy Act. But even if I wasn't, even if it meant that I would have to give up, I would still fight for a free and fair internet. Because as much as I've dreamt all my life of being a writer, and as much as I enjoy being able to support my family with the income from my creative labors, I want to bequeath a free and fair world to my daughter more than I want to be an artist, more than I've ever wanted to be an artist. Now, there are millions of ways to make money from the arts and trillions of ways to go broke trying to make money from the arts. Ensuring that the artists who do succeed get as much of the money in the system as possible is a noble goal. But even more than that, artists should be opposed to censorship and surveillance and control because the art should never be on the side of censorship and surveillance and control. Try anything and everything you can to make your coin land edge on. But if you need to break the internet to accomplish your trick, then you're on the wrong side of history. Thank you.